Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can America's history of recognizing and coping with environmental hazards tell us about how we might manage the challenges of climate change? Collective anxieties about the damaging effects of human activity on the ecosystem are not new, and my guest today will tell us that in the past, they have led to the creation of agencies like the EPA and of successful campaigns to clean up polluted water and air, preserve endangered species, neutralize acid rain, and shrink the hole in the ozone layer. But do these issues, all characterized as emergencies at one time or another, also suggest a pattern of overstating the potential dangers of environmental hazards and of underestimating our ability to deal with them effectively? Patrick Allitt is a professor of American history at Emory University. His new book is called A Climate of Crisis, America in the Age of Environmentalism. Patrick, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here.
You say that American concerns over environmental problems have intensified as overall standards of living have improved. Can you explain that?
Yes. After the Second World War, America had an enormous middle class whose basic needs were very, very well cared for. They lived in good houses, had good vehicles, had good education for their children, had access to good vacations, but then became worried about the side effects of the success of their industrialization and became increasingly preoccupied by the environment, but not because their situation was getting worse, but because it was getting better. They now had the ability to object to conditions which previously they hadn't had the leisure or the prosperity to be able to worry about.
So it's almost like moving up the hierarchy of needs. Suddenly, basic problems are taken care of so we can take a broader view of other things that we might improve?
Exactly. If you look at the history of environmentalism, it's flourished in wealthy countries, places like the United States and Canada and the countries of Western Europe and Japan. And within those countries, it's prospered mainly among the wealthier people within those societies. The environmental organizations would love to have more members from poor and minority groups, but find it very difficult to interest such people in environmentalism because those people say we've got more basic needs we must take care of first.
Now, do you feel like it's mutually exclusive that we have to take care of basic needs first globally as a society before it makes sense to look at environmental problems?
Yes, I do. Throughout the history of the world, most people have been desperately poor and their life expectancy has been short because of it. It's only industrialization which has ever been successful in eliminating mass poverty and introducing the possibility of mass prosperity. And although industrialization carries with it an environmental cost, it's still much better to live in an industrial society, even a dirty one, than to live in a clean pre-industrial society, because those are places where life is terribly, terribly vulnerable.
So your concern is that we could overreact to the problems we're seeing in the environment and actually chip away at the gains that have come from industrialization?
Exactly. It's certainly a good idea to be very aware of environmental problems. And I wrote the book because I'm very interested in the environment and I hope that we'll be able to continue to improve it. But I think we need to have a more realistic sense of how severe the dangers are, and we need never to forget what a blessing it is that we live in an industrial world rather than a pre-industrial one.
So we should note that you approach this issue from an academic background in history rather than in science, but I'm curious about how much you had to learn about the science in order to put the history in perspective and how you went about that.
Yes, I've been teaching courses in environmental history for about the past 15 or 20 years, and so that's led to me reading quite extensively in the scientific literature. But what you said is exactly right. I'm a historian, not a scientist, and so I certainly can't claim any particular scientific insight into the details of each of the questions that are currently controversial. On the other hand, once you start studying the history of science, you realize that that is itself a very, very human enterprise, and that although scientists struggle for objectivity and struggle to be completely impartial, they're very, very heavily influenced by the social environment in which they live. That's why when we look back at scientists from 100 years ago who thought that they were doing absolutely objective science, we're often struck by the way in which they were unconsciously influenced by the preoccupations and prejudices of their own time. So I think it's equally reasonable to assume that in the future, people looking back on scientists of our generation will also say, look at the way in which the issues of the early 21st century influenced how they addressed various problems.
So you open the book at a really interesting time in recent history, at the close of World War II, when we were terrified by this new threat, right, the possibility of nuclear annihilation. How did those concerns manifest themselves in new worries about things like contamination and overpopulation and even exhaustion of finite natural resources?
Yes, the obviously it was in 1945 that the Americans developed and tested and then used atomic bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then in the late 40s and 1950s, they began testing them. The Soviet Union joined in after 1949. And the result in the 50s was the steady growth in the background radiation level in the atmosphere, which was linked by scientists to increases in leukemia and skin cancer. More and more people started to become afraid of nuclear contamination, which was particularly sinister because it's invisible and tasteless and odorless. So on the one hand, it's imperceptible, but on the other hand, it's deadly. And I do think that the anxiety generated by that threat, well, it had many effects. Obviously, it led to a series of disaster movies like Dr. Strangelove or On the Beach. But it also led to people who are interested in or concerned about other issues to transfer the anxiety from the nuclear question to others. A classic example would be overpopulation. When Paul Ehrlich wrote his best-selling book, he called it the population bomb. In other words, just as nuclear bombs can explode, so population can. I'm not sure it was really a very suitable title, because the population bomb didn't happen because suddenly more people were being born, but because so many fewer were dying. People were being able to survive. And he was concerned that the world would become overpopulated. In the 1960s also, that's the decade when Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962. And to her astonishment, this book about chemistry became a bestseller, a book full of equations. That's something that never happens normally with writers about chemistry. She said, springtime returns after the snow melts, but everything is silent. Why? Because the birds have all been killed by the indiscriminate use of pesticides. And she went on to say, our chemical industry prides itself on the idea that it's making the world better and safer, but perhaps it's actually making the world more hazardous and more dangerous. And that was the first of many books which set off a concern about the possibility that new chemicals were being introduced into the environment so rapidly that people hadn't been able to adapt hadn't been able to evolve in such a way as to adapt, such that they were becoming a plague of carcinogens. In 1978, Samuel Epstein wrote a book called The Politics of Cancer, in which he said, cancer rates are rising very, very rapidly now, and it's because of all the chemicals we've put out into the environment. Similarly, in the early 1970s, a book called The Limits to Growth from the Club of Rome made the claim that the population was now so big, economic growth was roaring ahead so fast, we were literally going to run out of raw materials, and that by the year 2000, we'd live a much poorer and more impoverished life than we did at the time, because there simply wasn't enough stuff in the world to keep things going. So I think all those are examples of the way in which the anxiety about what looks like a prosperous world, these are authors making the claim just behind the prosperity lies catastrophe.
Is it characteristic that each time we have sort of believed that these challenges, at least in the moment, seemed insurmountable?
Yes, I think that the all the authors of these studies underestimated the degree to which human ingenuity and human adaptability would find ways to cope. I mean, let me give you a couple of astonishing surprises. One is the discovery that, although it's certainly true that population was rising very, very rapidly, it's also true that the food-to-population ratio throughout much of this period was actually improving. In other words, there was more food available to feed the 7 billion people that we have now than there was to feed the 2 billion people back in 1950. A combination of the Green Revolution and the development of genetically modified crops created more than enough surplus for us to be able to feed the world's population better. And similarly, the development of a much better infrastructure, giving us more access to more people, and the improvements in things like refrigeration, which leads to a decline in the amount of food that's wasted and spoiled, has meant that we're better placed now for feeding the world's population than we've ever been. That's an incredible testament to human adaptability and creativity.
Of course, some of these solutions come with complications of their own.
They all come with solutions, with complications. There's no question that we hardly ever have a gain which is entirely cost-free. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one of the great political controversies surrounding the environment has been the question of the degree to which businesses, free enterprise, should be constricted or constrained by government regulation. And one of the themes of the book is that everybody exaggerates on these issues. I do think that environmentalists have often been guilty of exaggerating the bad news as they see it. On the other hand, it's also true that business is often exaggerated and claimed that if they're forced to comply with legislation about cleaning up their industrial processes, they simply won't be able to afford it and they'll go out of business. And every single time a piece of environmental legislation has been introduced into Congress, and every time the EPA writes a new set of regulations, that complaint is always made, and it nearly always proves to be untrue. In fact, very often the creation of new regulations sets off an opportunity for industrial or for environmental entrepreneurs to look for cleaner and better ways of doing it. So yes, we have to be realistic about the fact that there's a price to be paid. But on the whole, we find that the price is manageable. It isn't catastrophic.
Patrick Allitt is my guest. He is professor of American history at Emory University and author of the new book, A Climate of Crisis, America in the Age of Environmentalism. You can be part of the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, by emailing think@kera.org, or sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Patrick Allitt, professor of American history at Emory University and author of the new book, A Climate of Crisis, America in the Age of Environmentalism. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Patrick, what's the difference between an anti-environmentalist and a counter-environmentalist?
Anti-environmentalists are people who believe that environmentalism was more trouble than it was worth, or in fact that it was a fuss about nothing. A good example would be President Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, who was openly contemptuous of the environmental organization leaders and refused to meet with them. President Reagan was surprised to discover that environmentalism was actually quite popular in the Republican Party, and finally had to hastily get rid of James Watt in order to restore his credibility with Republican environmentalists. On the other hand, there are lots of people who are sympathetic to environmental causes, but are skeptical about the ways in which the environmental organizations have often gone about it. The most famous of them at the moment is probably a man called Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist just about the turn of the century, in which he examined one by one the environmental controversies and challenged the orthodox view of each of them to say, although it's certainly true that these are that we have these problems, they're very manageable problems, and we're in danger of overreacting. Especially, I mean, he was particularly concerned with alarms about global warming. He said, it's a problem, but it's a manageable problem. We've got to make sure that we don't do too much to inhibit economic growth, which is itself a very desirable thing. So I think that's a distinction necessary to make. I claim in the book that the counter-environmentalists are people who are themselves sympathetic to environmental objectives, particularly that we should create a cleaner and better world, but doubtful about the alarms and doubtful about some of the methods being proposed.
To the extent that you believe some in the environmental movement have been sort of historically prone to hyperbolic speech about this, why do you think they've resorted to that? Is that the only way they feel they can get the rest of the country to pay attention?
Yes, it's partly a matter of politics as normal. I mean, if you're very concerned about an issue, you're going to have an incentive to exaggerate the seriousness of it in order to wake other people up to it. And certainly the history of environmentalism in the late 1960s and early 1970s shows that that was very, very effective. Suddenly, politicians on all sides of the spectrum began to pay attention because this new constituency had crystallized around a series of issues, particularly the question of pollution. I mean, that is how you motivate politicians. It's striking to me that soon after his election, President Nixon, who'd had no previous interest in the environment, started recognizing, and his advisors started to tell him, the environment is such an important issue among voters now that we've got to get on board with this. So it was with his active encouragement that Congress passed the National Environmental Policy Act and that the EPA came into existence, and that Congress passed a whole succession of very effective environmental laws over the ensuing years. On the other hand, it is true sometimes that the hype gets a little bit disproportionate. I mean, I mentioned earlier Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb. One of the claims he made was, by the 1980s, people in the United States and in Western Europe are going to be starving to death in massive famines. And he said it with great authority. And of course, this proved to be completely untrue. Similarly, the people who wrote The Limits to Growth, who said, we're going to be running out of resources by the year 2000, again, completely false. They'd underestimated human creativity, and their alarms seemed to me, not only were they disproportionate, but it ought to have been clear to them at the time that they were disproportionate.
What would you say to people who counter that there is an overwhelming majority of climate scientists who appear to agree, if not on the exact specifics of the models of what might take place as the planet warms, they generally agree that the planet is warming due to human activity?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. There's no question that global warming is going on, and there's no question that part of the warming is caused by human activity. I think both those things are clear. What's much more difficult to do is to predict the future, or even to project the future. I mean, we've got a lot of historical studies of future predictions which were made in the past, nearly all of which turned out to be completely false. I mean, history is so complicated, and as society becomes more complex, it becomes even harder to anticipate what will happen next. So I'm certainly not aligned in any way with people who simply deny that global warming is happening. That's just it's overwhelmingly false to make that claim. We know it is happening. What we don't know is the degree to which, we don't know about the rate at which it's going to continue, and we don't know the degree to which it's human induced. We do know that the warming's been going on for 300 or 400 years, and so the difficult part is to decide what other causes are involved and to what degree is human action intensifying it, and what are the most effective ways for human activity to act as a restraint on it.
Can you tell us a little bit, Patrick, about the history of the political polarization of environmental issues? Has this always been a sort of pitched battle between the left and the right?
No, it hasn't been. I mentioned the Nixon administration previously, which was clearly crucial in putting environmental politics onto the mainstream agenda. The first Earth Day took place in 1970, April the 22nd, 1970, and it was an immense demonstration. Far more people showed up for Earth Day than had turned out in any of the civil rights or any of the anti-Vietnam or any of the women's rights demonstrations. The people who organized it, well, it was a Democratic senator, Gaylord Nelson, helped by Dennis Hayes, who was a Harvard Law student, and they were absolutely astonished at what an incredible response they got. Thousands of events took place on campuses and schools and churches and civic groups all over the nation. And so that was a time when there was a very, very high degree of consensus on both sides of the political aisle that environmental legislation was necessary. And through the 70s, that remained true. President Carter in the late 70s was also very keen. A fairly sharp turn came in the beginning of the Reagan administration. But even then, as I mentioned, Reagan noticed that a brazenly anti-environmental policy was intolerable. And when he fired James Watt, he brought back William Ruckelshaus to be Secretary of the Interior, or to be EPA Administrator, the man who'd been the first administrator and who'd generated a good publicity for environmentalism itself. In the 80s, increasingly, Republicans became more and more skeptical, particularly about big federal programs which were bureaucratically top-heavy and costly to comply with. And since then, there has been more and more of a parting of the ways, with Democrats tending to be very sympathetic to environmental causes, perhaps best signified by somebody like Al Gore, and Republicans tending to be more and more skeptical. And of course, because there were so many environmental false alarms, the Republicans who say, well, we've heard all this before and it all turned out to be false, can in fact draw on several historical examples.
There are interesting discussions now of whether the concerns we have about climate change might be ameliorated by new technologies, the discovery of alternative fuel sources that do not contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. On the other hand, there are people who say we simply need to change behavior. Can you talk a little bit about what history would suggest about one or the other or a combination of different effects being useful in order to fix the problems that we had?
Yes, let me give you a long-term and a short-term response to that. In the long term, fossil fuels are spectacular for how clean they are. That sounds like a paradox, I know, but I think it's true. Back in the 1870s, urban planners were saying, cities aren't going to be able to grow any bigger now because the horse manure problem is going to be completely unmanageable. As it is, we're ankle deep in horse manure as horses do all the transportation in town. And by the year 1920, we're going to be waist deep in horse manure. And so it's just then, of course, that as the incentive for a new form of transportation intensified, first electric streetcars and then internal combustion engines were developed and deployed very effectively in the first motorized vehicles. And at the time, what impressed everybody was not how dirty they were, but how incredibly clean they were. It's much, much better to have a city run by electric streetcars and cars than it is by horses. Over the course of the 20th century, vehicles have become more and more efficient. We're now capable of making cars that do 100 miles to the gallon. So in the long run, it's reasonable to look at the technologies we've got, even though they are certainly polluters, as demonstrations of technological progress towards a cleaner environment. At the moment, it's also true that we're more and more efficient in our use of fuels, and we could easily get a lot more so. We've just decided not to do so. It's also true that finally, after a long period of latency, wind power is finally approaching economic competitiveness with most of the other fuel sources. It still can't compete with oil, and still for the foreseeable future, we will need a lot of oil and natural gas. But wind power, which has been developed and improved over the last 30 or 40 years, is getting better and better, as is solar technology. There are people who speculate that we'll never even use all the available oil because we'll be able to use fully renewable sources instead. So the longer-term history of the technologies is a deeply reassuring history. It shows us that we can generate more and more energy and that we can do it with less and less pollution.
Does it make sense to you to consider government subsidies or incentives equal to or even greater than those that have been given to the conventional fossil fuels industry for renewables?
It can be useful, but it can also go wrong, and I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. For example, the ethanol program began in the Carter administration. Jimmy Carter himself was convinced that resources were scarce and were becoming more scarce, so he supported the idea of subsidies. Now, unfortunately, the ethanol experiment hasn't turned out very well. Crops which otherwise would be used for food has taken a lot of food out of the food stream around the world, with the effect that that's tended to push food prices up. And ethanol hasn't proved sufficient to replace conventional fossil fuels. So I think there's good arguments to be made. In fact, they are being made on the left and the right, that ethanol was a well-intentioned but actually a blundering policy which ought not to have been encouraged. On the other hand, it's certainly usually sensible for government to take an interest in new possibilities. And always, of course, when we're looking at things like energy policy, we're not only looking at the question of side effects and pollution. We're also looking at the geopolitics of it. At the moment, now that Russia is so threatening in its current posture towards the Ukraine and Crimea, ways for the United States and ways for Western Europe to be less dependent upon Russian oil and gas are clearly highly desirable for that reason. And we always need to keep those factors in view as well.
Patrick Allitt is my guest. He's professor of American history at Emory University and author of the new book, A Climate of Crisis, America in the Age of Environmentalism. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We will be taking your calls after this break. We'll also read some emails if you've got them at think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of American History at Emory University, Patrick Allitt. His new book is called A Climate of Crisis, America in the Age of Environmentalism. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Patrick, can you speak to the risks one way or another of either over-responding or under-responding to what at any point in our history, including now, appear to be environmental crises?
Yes, I think that the possibility of overreacting is a matter of inhibiting economic growth. Although economic growth brings with it problems, nevertheless, it lifts entire populations out of poverty. And we've seen over the course of the last couple of centuries that that's it's overwhelmingly desirable. There's the possibility of under-responding is being too slow to introduce benign regulations. I do think, for example, that the evidence of the last 40 or 50 years shows us how good it was that Congress passed the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. Americans really did live with very high levels of pollution, and we now live in an incomparably cleaner atmosphere than our parents and grandparents. This is also the same period in which all the anti-smoking legislation took place, with the result that both indoors and outdoors we live in a much cleaner world, and it's good that we should do so. So clearly those are strong arguments in favor of the importance of regulation. On the other hand, I do think that Americans, if anything, or American governments have been too slow to regulate things like where people can live. It's clearly a very bad idea to let people live along coastlines, which are periodically afflicted by very, very severe storms. Sandy and Katrina were both examples of storms afflicting areas which were excessively vulnerable. Periodically, the Mississippi flooding has had the same consequences. Government should probably do more to prevent people from living in such areas so that they won't then be inundated and so that they won't then become a liability to everybody else.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ed in Duncanville. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I fear that your guest is being a little bit too enthusiastic about the ability of people recuperate. Specifically, he said that, you know, we tend to overreact to environmental problems. And I'm real curious as to which ones we've overreacted at. And to save time, let me just state that my view is not that these environmental problems were not serious, but that people took them seriously and acted to avoid problems. So the ozone hole is gone not because it wasn't a problem, but because, well, it's not gone yet, but because people acted. DDT, Rachel Carson's complaint, not because Carson was wrong. In fact, 1,000 later studies found she's right, but because people took her serious.
What do you think about that, Patrick?
That's a very good point. I half agree. It's certainly true that the hole in the ozone layer is a very good example of sensible action and timely action by the international community. The discovery in the 1970s that chlorofluorocarbons were hazardous led to collective action, the Montreal Protocol of 1987, with the result that we were able to phase out the manufacture of chlorofluorocarbons and ratchet down the hazard which they represented. I think the story of DDT is more complicated, and that it helps to put it in historical context. At the time DDT was invented, it was regarded as such a brilliant invention that its inventor, Paul Muller, was given a medical Nobel Prize. It really was by far the most effective chemical ever found up to that time for the abatement of malarial mosquitoes. And the use of DDT in places like southern Italy and Sardinia and Sri Lanka, Ceylon as it was then, had phenomenally positive effects. Rachel Carson was certainly right to criticize the indiscriminate use of DDT, but a subsequent pattern of arguments has made the claim, I think plausibly, that the elimination of DDT as one of the chemicals that we can use for selective and careful elimination of malaria is actually deeply regrettable. So that seems to me like a more ambiguous case.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to James in Fort Worth. Hi, James.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's very important subject, and I was kind of curious.
I mean, so much of it would be better for all of us, everyone, if we would look to find sources of energy that didn't pollute the environment, that were renewable and could be used inexhaustibly. But the problem is that there's so much money being made right now from the use of fossil fuels. Doesn't that present such a huge burden towards actually changing anything, because our economy is so dependent upon its use and consumption? So, and given our general, I mean, lately, I mean, with cases, when it comes, the cases that we talked about earlier, as far as how President Nixon did this or that, he did it in response. There was a large number of people in the country during that time who were concerned about the environment and its effect. Now, with the passage of laws like Citizens United and the money that can influence our government is so strong that it makes folks feel as if they have less of an opportunity to really make those kind of changes. It seems.
Well, James, thank you so much for your call. Lots on the table there. Do you feel, Patrick, like money is an obstacle here to doing the right thing?
Sometimes it certainly is, because, of course, people, once they have vested interests, will lobby very hard to try to maintain the status of those interests. On the other hand, corporations can't afford bad public relations. I think it's very interesting that after the Three Mile Island disaster in 1979, American utility companies dropped out of the nuclear power station industry because they knew how unpopular it was, and they didn't want to be the focus of angry citizens' fury. Similarly, after the Deepwater Horizon incident a couple of years ago, BP faced an enormous public relations problem, which it's tried very hard to compensate for by generously compensating the victims. In other words, corporations do have an incentive to have a good public reputation. And sometimes the corporations themselves recognize that they've simply got to change the way they're doing things. They usually grumble about it, but then they accede. One of the things that's so encouraging about the American situation is that we do have freedom of the press, we do have freedom of speech, citizens are entitled to sue the agencies. In other words, private citizens can sue the EPA if they feel that it's not doing its job properly. And that means that the agencies, like the corporations, have got a very high incentive to keep up to the mark and to make sure that they're doing things which the citizens approve of. Yes, they're doing it because they want to make money, but there are ways in which we regard their making of money tolerable and ways we regard as intolerable.
I want to ask about this as we close out the hour. In the past, many of the environmental problems that we have had to cope with were relatively local as compared with something like climate change. So, for example, if pollution was happening, many of the effects were concentrated in a particular region. That's not a good thing for that region, but it didn't affect other regions, and so it could sort of be locally handled. In this one, what we're hearing is that resources that we use here and gases that we put into the environment here might affect people half a world away who live in a very different area. Can you talk about sort of what we need to consider with regard to our obligations to places that may not be contributing greenhouse gases, but that may feel the effect of this booming American economy that does put greenhouse gases into the environment?
I think that's one of the central ethical questions that we do have to face at the moment. And it's a complicated one. It's certainly true that the United States has industrialized and now generates an enormous percentage of the world's greenhouse gases. But what the other countries which are currently being afflicted by, what they need most is industrialization of their own. I mean, for example, at the moment, China and India are going through phases of crash industrialization, and they're polluting at a very, very intense level. China at the moment is famously dirty. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be doing it. Their view is, until we've brought our populations out of mass poverty, we can't be too scrupulous about the emission of CO2. If we don't have industrialization, tens of thousands of people will continue to die prematurely. It's true that global warming is a danger, but its danger lies mainly in the future, and its victims so far are hypothetical victims. They're people who don't even exist yet. Whereas the current victims of poverty are real people who are alive in the world now, whom we need to be attentive to. So I think the Americans who are anxious about this problem need to blend an enthusiasm for encouraging and for nurturing economic growth elsewhere, along with an enlightened attempt to mitigate the degree of their own emissions in the atmosphere.
My guest has been Patrick Allitt, professor of American history at Emory University. His new book is called A Climate of Crisis, America in the Age of Environmentalism. Patrick, very interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.